Reading from the Sermon on the Mount, Count 1, Chapter 17, Verse 18. Navayam klesha bijani, yatasyu purusharshaba, purusham tam vijanimo, vakya veda vimohita, not vayam, we. Klesha bijani, the root cause of sufferings. Yata, where from? Su, it so happens. Purusha rashaba, O greatest of all human beings. Purusham, the person, tam, that, bijanimo, no. Vakyaveda, difference of opinion, vimohita, bewildered by. Translation, O greatest among human beings, it is very difficult to ascertain the particular miscreant who has caused our sufferings, because we are bewildered by all the different opinions of theoretical philosophers. Purport, there are many theoretical philosophers in the world who put forward their own theories of cause and effect, especially about the cause of suffering and its effects on different living beings. Generally, there are six great philosophers: Kanada, the author of Vaisheshika philosophy; Gotama, the author of logic; Patanjali, the author of mystic yoga; Kapila, the author of Sankhya philosophy; Jaimini, the author of Karma Mimamsa; and Vyasadeva, the author of Vedanta Darshana. Although the bull, or the personality of religion, and the cow, the personality of the earth, knew perfectly well that the personality of Kali was the direct cause of their sufferings, still, as devotees of the Lord, they knew well also that without the sanction of the Lord, no one could inflict trouble upon them. According to the Padma Purana, our present trouble is due to the fructifying of seedling sins. But even those seedling sins also gradually fade away by execution of pure devotional service. Thus, even if the devotees see the mischief mongers and they do not accuse them for the sufferings inflicted, they take it for granted that the mischief monger is made to act by some indirect cause, and therefore they tolerate the sufferings, thinking them to be God-given in small doses, or otherwise the sufferings should have been greater. Maharaj Pariksha wanted to get a statement of accusation against the direct mischief-monger, but they declined to give it on the above-mentioned grounds. Speculative philosophers, however, do not recognize the sanction of the Lord. They try to find out the cause of sufferings in their own way, as will be described in the following verses. According to Srila Jiva Goswami, such speculators are themselves bewildered, and thus they cannot know that the ultimate cause of all causes is the Supreme Lord, the personality of Godhead. Translation, O greatest among human beings, it is very difficult to ascertain the particular miscreant who causes our sufferings, because we are bewildered by all the different opinions of theoretical philosophers. So this is Dharma speaking, the bull. And of course, Dharma means someone who is very knowledgeable of the laws of the Supreme Lord. Yamaraj's dharma also. Yamaraj knows very well the laws because he has to punish everyone. And he's more or less in charge of the law of karma. So, why is the bull speaking in this way? Oh, we don't know what is the cause of our suffering. And of course, Prabhupada explains in the purport that yes, they know it is Kali personified. Kali has beaten the legs of the bull. That's the direct cause. But in a very humble mood, they say, oh, we cannot understand because we are bewildered by different philosophies or theories, vakya beda, different statements have been made about what is the cause of suffering. So in a general way, of course, this is a problem in theology or religion. Why do we suffer? And if there's a supreme, of course, if there's no God, it doesn't matter. It's not a problem. But if there is a God and we suffer, then there is a problem, because we'll say, why God allows us to suffering if he knows about it, because he's all knowledgeable, and if he's all powerful, why doesn't he prevent it? He should prevent it if he's all powerful. And if he doesn't prevent it, that means he's not compassionate. He's cruel. So if we suffer in this material world, we can accuse God of being cruel. And if he's cruel, he's not perfect. If he's not perfect, how can he be God? So therefore, there is no God. So we can make some argument like that. But this is a doubt that will arise in many people's minds. What is the, why do you have to suffer in this material world? Is God responsible for our suffering? So there is a problem in theology. I think Christian theology probably has some explanation, but some years ago this whole thing came out. It was, why do we suffer, why does God make us suffer? Why do good people suffer, etc.? Someone wrote a book, I think a reverend or a priest wrote a book like this. Why do good people suffer? Because it's a perplexing problem, and people often ask this question. So, I don't know exactly what he answered to that. But here we see there are various opinions about the matter. Vakya Veda. Many people say different things. So within the Vedic realm, we do have different opinions. And Prabhupada here mentions the different darshanas that arise from the Vedic authority. We have Kanada, who is the Vaisheshika philosopher, who says everything comes from a combination of little particles called atoms, and they get together and they form bigger things, and the bigger things come together and make bigger things, and eventually we get matter as we know it and bodies, etc. So something like the atomic theory in the modern world. We have Gautama, who is responsible for Nyaya or logic. He accepts the Supreme Lord. There's some Ishvara up there. And there is Jiva, there is an Atma, and there is Prakriti. And very similar to the Sankhya philosophy that we have in the Bhagavatam, where we have the five elements and the tanmatras, the sense objects, and we have the senses, the action senses, and the knowledge-gathering senses, and we have the mind, and we have the sense devatas, and we got Ahankara, Mahatattva, and Prakriti, same system. So his theory is through logic we can get liberation. And liberation means that the jiva frees himself from Prakriti. Lord is not really involved in all of this. He's there, but he's not involved. Patanjali, of course, is famous for the Yoga Sutras. So he established the process of yoga and meditation. He mentions there also that one should worship the Supreme Lord. But most of the persons following him actually try to approach the impersonal aspect of the Lord, if anything. Or, even not that far, they get as far as understanding their Atma, not the body. The whole goal of that yoga system is Chitta Vritti Nirodha, to destroy the functions of consciousness, that is material consciousness. That is all the mental things, thoughts, desires, emotions, concepts, etc., intellect. You stop all that thing, stuff going on in your mind. When you stop it all, then Atma reveals itself. And so that's his goal. So it is impersonal, to say. Atma Jnana or Brahma Jnana. Though he recognizes the Lord, nevertheless he just concentrates on his impersonalism. In Kapila, a Sankhya philosopher, not the Kapila of the Bhagavatam, who puts Prakriti below Supreme Lord, in his system he has all the things that are the same as the Bhagavatam, except there's no Supreme Lord. So Prakriti goes on by itself. Prakriti and Jiva produce the material world, basically. And Jaimini, who was famous for the Karma Mimamsa philosophy. One would assume that because he's a follower of the Vedas that he would accept the Supreme Lord, but he actually doesn't. He says we can just follow the injunctions of the Veda and be happy in this material world. And we don't have to strive for liberation. Just go to Svargaloka by doing sacrifices, doing our duties. So all of that law is already set up. We don't have to think about whether there's a Lord or there's no Lord or whatever. Just follow the rules, do your sacrifice, go to Svargaloka. Finished. And then, of course, we have Veda Vyas, who wrote the Brahma Sutras to give the real meaning of the Upanishads. So here we see that there's six different philosophers who say, we follow the Vedas. So they're not independent philosophers in the sense that we have in the West some people, they just think on their own and come up with something like Plato or Socrates, etc. Or modern philosophers, they just think on their own. So this is not the same. This type of philosophy is somewhat theological because it claims at least a basis in the Vedas. So they all accept the Vedic authority. As opposed to other philosophies like Charvaka, who's wrote philosophical works, but he says no Vedas, there's no authority in Vedas. Yeah. And what is Atma? The body. What is the goal in life? Enjoyment. That's his theory. So he wrote all philosophy based on this. So rejection of the Vedas. And of course we have the Jain philosophy, they also reject the Vedas, the Buddhist philosophy, they also reject the Vedas. But even those that accept the Vedas come up with a different philosophy, various philosophies. Some of them don't accept Ishvara, the Supreme Lord at all, like Sankhya. In spite of the fact that, we accept the Vedas. And others accept the Supreme Lord, but he doesn't have much of a function. As in Nyaya philosophy. So we have various types of systems claiming we follow the Vedas, but actually we have to reject these because they misinterpret the meaning of the Vedas. So the conclusion of the Vaishnavas is that the only person among these six darshanas who tells the truth is Vedavyas. And he's made the conclusion in the Brahma Sutras, or the Vedanta Sutras. The Vedanta Sutras is an explanation of the statements of the Upanishads. Now, of course, these other authors also will take the same statements and try to, some of the statements, selective statements, and make their philosophy. So he counters all of this using the statements of the Upanishads to show that they are selectively taking certain statements, ignoring other statements out of context. So the conclusion of all of this is that all these other philosophies are wrong. Even though they say, we follow the Vedas. No, we have to reject them all as being false. And then what is established is, of course, some of these have something correct. So, yes, Prakriti is there. And we have all the, the Mahatattva and the mind and the elements, etc. Yes, that part's true of Samkhya and Nyaya philosophy. And they all accept the Atma. So, yes, Vedavyas also accepts Atma. But there is another entity that is Supreme Lord there, Ishvara. Now, some of these philosophies do accept, such as Nyaya philosophy accepts Ishvara also. But the Ishvara, or the Supreme Lord, doesn't have much of a function in that philosophy. So, Vedavyas says, no, the Supreme Lord, he is the main personality. He is the main person in this whole series of existing things, jivas, prakriti, and Ishvara. He is the main person. He is the independent person. And everything depends on him. So, we can't do anything without his sanction. So it is important that we recognize the Supreme Lord and not ignore him. The only philosophy which is correct is that of Vedavyas. And therefore, the explanation of suffering in this world, why do we suffer, will not be correct with these other philosophies because they don't have the proper understanding. They may accept Prakriti and Jiva, but they don't accept the Supreme Lord in the whole picture. So we come to the philosophy of Veda Vyas as pronounced in the Brahma Sutras. Now, of course, the Brahma Sutras is a little problem there because they misinterpret that also. We get various philosophers giving various conclusions. The two main ones are the main one is that Shankaracharya has written a commentary which is completely different from that of the Vaishnavas. Completely opposite. In which, oh yes, he accepts the Supreme Lord, but it is the Brahman. No qualities, no form, no activities of Supreme Lord at all. So, therefore, Vedavyasa himself saw that problem because he was advised by Narada Muni, this isn't going to be satisfying. So therefore, Vedavyasa wrote the Srimad Bhagavatam as the commentary on the Brahma Sutras, natural commentary on the Brahma Sutras. Natural because it's written by the author of the Vedanta Sutras. Yeah? So he wrote a commentary of the Vedanta Sutras to explain the Upanishads, and then he wrote the Srimad Bhagavatam to explain the Vedanta Sutras, or the Upanishads, which are the essence of the Vedas. So therefore, the Srimad Bhagavatam embodies all the Vedic knowledge. So, therefore, what is that explanation of why we suffer in the material world? So we come back to that problem again. Supreme Lord is there, he's all-powerful, omniscient, all-compassionate, and we're suffering in this material world in ignorance. So why does the Lord allow it? If we don't have a Supreme Lord there, you don't have to worry about it. If you have Brahman with no qualities and no form, you don't have to worry about that problem. And in fact, there's no jiva in Shankar's philosophy. So there is no suffering, really. There's no jiva suffering in the material world. It's an illusion of suffering only. You get rid of ignorance, and then you're back to Brahman again. So there is no suffering jiva in this material world at all. Actually, it's all illusory. That's his theory. So that's the one clever solution to the problem. It's that we're actually not suffering. It's an illusion. This, of course, is not very satisfying to most people. And it's also maybe our intuition will tell us that's not correct. Actually, I'm suffering. So, therefore, we have the version of Vedavyasa himself in the Brahma Sutras and Bhagavatam, of course, in the Vedas also, but it is clarified in the Bhagavatam. So, there is that problem. Yes, if the Lord is all powerful and all knowledgeable, all compassionate, then why do we suffer? So, the answer, the simple answer to it is that the Lord in no way is at fault because he does not directly cause the suffering. He is the cause of the jiva in one sense because everything is dependent on him. But of course the jivas are also eternal, so they're not produced or created at a certain time. They're eternal. But there is individuality in the jivas. And they decide what they want to do. They are responsible for the results of their actions. So, therefore, the suffering that we see for jivas in this material world is not created by the Supreme Lord, but created by the individual jivas. They create their own suffering. They are the cause of their suffering. And so it's not the Lord's at fault. This arises because the Lord has a control in one sense, and that is he makes a law of karma, which you cannot avoid. Whether you know it or don't know it, or whatever, the law acts like the law of nature, gravity, things fall, etc. So there's a law of karma for human beings. With every act, there's some quality attached to it. It is sinful or it's not sinful. And you get a result for that. If it's sinful, you get a suffering. If it's not sinful, you don't get the suffering. And if on the other hand, it is punya, it is something recommended in the Vedas to do, you get enjoyment. So, in this way, there's a law built into the material world which you can't see, and you probably can't even prove it directly. It's called adrishta, the unseen factor. That's karma. So you do activities and you think you get a result right now. You hold this, you pick up the card. It's a result, it's a direct result. So there's immediate results that we see. There's the long-term result we don't see in our next body or the next body or the next body. Or maybe for many, many lifetimes, a single karma effect can continue. So that result that we get, long-term result, that's the part we don't see. That is what we call karma or daiva or adrishta. So this is the law inherent in the material world. It is part of Maya. It is not material like this. It's not prakriti as such. So it's distinct from prakriti. But it's part of Maya. It's part of the material world. A very subtle aspect like time. Time also is not material. So time and karma or daiva are subtle aspects of the material world. And then we have the gross aspects, that is prakriti and ahankara and mahatattva, etc., mind and material elements and senses and all that. That's all gross. So we have the subtle aspect of maya, that is law of karma operating. So, why is the law there? It's under the control of the Supreme Lord. It's inherent in material world. Along with prakriti, we have law of karma and time going on, and we cannot separate it. It's the under the Supreme Lord. That part he's responsible for. So, we don't have to suffer in the material world. If you do the good activities, you get good results and you enjoy. You don't suffer. So the suffering, therefore, is the jiva's decision to do activities that excessively interfere with other jivas and cause them pain. And then you get bad results on yourself. That's the suffering. So, of course, we can ask, well, why the Lord makes a rule like that? Why can't we just have all enjoyment in the material world? Anything you do, you get enjoyment. Well, there's a problem there also. Because that would also be unjust. So when you cause harm to others and you kill animals and you kill human beings, you can all keep on enjoying forever. Then that would also be a very unjust law, according to our natural sense of justice. So it looks like it's a naturally just law. You do good activities, you get good results, you do bad activities, and you have to suffer for it. Just like in the system of the country. You do criminal activities, you have to go to jail and get fined and suffer and whatever. You do good activities, they reward you. So it's natural. It's a natural law. So we shouldn't criticize that law. So why do jivas act like this? Why do they do the bad activities, the sinful activities, instead of the good activities? Answer is ignorance. So they say, why does the Lord make us ignorant? Why does He make us all full of knowledge so we recognize this is good activity, this is bad activity? Huh? So this again is a matter of choice. We can choose to be ignorant or we can choose to get knowledge. We can choose to be in the material world or we can choose not to be in the material world. Huh? Of course, it is a little bit difficult to get out and get rid of that ignorance, but yes, there's a choice there. If we choose not to fall into ignorance, we can accomplish that. We can do that. As a human being, as an animal or plant, we can't do that. There's no choice. As a human being, we have the choice. The only thing is to make that choice and then get a good result, we have to follow scripture. There's something wrong here. We have to follow, get the right knowledge to do it. If we haphazardly try to, you know, get rid of our ignorance, it doesn't work too well. Some philosophers partially succeed. They get part of the answer, like Plato or someone. Yes, part of it is correct. So independently, we can get some partial answers, and this is what the Gyanis also do. Yeah? They use their intellect and try to discover the cause of suffering. So if we have scripture, of course, then we have a little bit of an advantage. So Prabhupada also mentions this about the bija of suffering. So the scriptures tell us, suffering is caused by karma, which means actions, and what to say, sinful actions, violent actions. Violent actions are caused by desires. We have a desire for some sort of enjoyment. We have a desire for us to afflict somebody because we're angry or whatever. Anger is just another form of desire. So that is one bija, desire. Why do we have desires? We have desires because we want to be happy. We want to enjoy. That is why we have desires. So we could say, well, why does the Lord give us this propensity to have desires to enjoy? So the answer, of course, is that yes, we have a right to be happy. We have a right to enjoy. The nature of the jiva is, he's a bhokta. Bhokta means enjoyer, literally. Of course, not literally just the jiva's enjoying all the material world, but it means an experiencer. So the nature of the jiva too is experience, and obviously the jiva does not like to experience pain and suffering. So he wants to get some happiness of some sort. So the main problem here is how to get that happiness. So the jiva is thinking, I want some happiness. And then what is supplied to him is a material body, which he identifies with, and some material objects. And he thinks, I am the body, and I contact these objects, and I get stimulation, and this gives me happiness. So we have the ahankara acting with the atma and the subtle body, and then we contact objects, and there's stimulation there, and we get some effects on our brain, and then we think this is pleasure, something happens in the brain, pleasure centers there, and we think happiness. So this is what happens. So the next question is, well, why does the Lord do that? Why does he make us put this whole indirect process of getting a body and all that there? And the reason is because the jiva is attempting to get independent enjoyment for himself. And why does he do that? Because of avidya, ignorance, ajnana. So ajnana, or ignorance, is like the root cause. The root bija, so the root of suffering. So it's the root cause, klesha bija. We have karma, and then behind that we have desires, and behind that we have avidya. This is mentioned in the Nectar Devotion, where it talks about klesha gni, destruction of klesha. First quality of bhakti is to destroy klesha. So three levels, destroy the karma, destroy the desires, destroy the ignorance. So, the ignorance starts with the jiva thinking, I am an independent entity with a right to my own enjoyment. That's the essential ignorance of the jiva. And that is the cause of ahankara and material body, and then enjoying these objects in the material world. So, this is the choice of the jiva. I want to enjoy for myself. That is the essential ignorance, which causes everything in the material world. So all the jivas in the material world have this basic ignorance, and over that they have all of their coverings. And then they act and they get their results in terms of papa and punya and suffering and enjoyment. So therefore, the cause is ultimately the jiva. He chooses to enjoy independently. So the next question, why does the Lord give the jiva this funny choice of choosing to be independently want his enjoyment? Well, what's the other choice? The other choice is not to try to get enjoyment for the self, but to give enjoyment to the Supreme Lord. That is the process of bhakti. And when that's perfect, it is called prema. So the opposite of ignorance ultimately is prema. To give enjoyment to the Supreme Lord. And what happens when we do that? The jiva gets enjoyment. So he does get, he's a bhokta, so he does get happiness, but it is by giving up the sense of I have my happiness for myself. When he gives up that selfish idea, I should enjoy for myself, rather I should give something to the Supreme Lord, then he gets his enjoyment. So that is the simple process of rectifying this problem of suffering in the material world. So that is why we say that bhakti is klesha gni, that it destroys klesha, suffering. because it destroys all levels. It destroys the effects of karma, that is suffering in the material world. Ajamiyo did indirect bhakti, chanting Narayan's name, and he destroyed all his karmas. So when Yamaraj came to get him because he'd done sinful activities, Vishnudutta says, no, he hasn't got any karmas. Why? We saw him do the sinful acts. He chanted the name of Narayan. So therefore all of his sinful acts have just been destroyed. The results of sin for him. All of his, he would kidnap people and steal all their money, maybe even kill people. No effect. No karma for that. Why? Because he said the name Narayan. Accidentally even. If we have bhakti, of course, more than that happens. That he didn't name bhakti even. He just said Narayan, this is the name of my son. That's all. So, therefore, bhakti will destroy the karmas, the prarabdha forms and also the aprarabdha. That means those, the effects which from previous lifetimes, they're not even going to surface in this lifetime. We have effects of karma that are going to surface in next lifetime, next lifetime, next lifetime, next lifetime. They're all waiting somewhere in your subtle body. So all of those get destroyed, plus the ones in this life also get destroyed. So that's the karma aspect. Prarabdha and aparabdha karmas all get destroyed. Not only that, the desires to commit the acts which cause the karmas, that also is destroyed. That's the bija. So those desires to enjoy in the material world get destroyed. How does that happen? Because the very root of the desires, as I said, is that ignorance. That I am an independent, enjoying entity. That concept is destroyed because with bhakti, you can't have that. Krishna is the enjoyer. So when we think of Krishna as the enjoyer, I'm not the enjoyer, then this eradicates that ignorance, that ajnana, that avidya. So therefore, the avidya and the desires and the karma, effects of karma, are all destroyed by the process of bhakti. That is kleshagni. So this is the effective process of eradicating this suffering in the material world. So the cause is not the Supreme Lord. He makes a law by which we have suffering, but the actual cause of the suffering is the ignorance of the jiva, his desire to be separate from the Supreme Lord and enjoy on his own selfishly in the material world. And consequently, he's subject to the laws of karma, etc. And then this all happens. So, it's the choice of the jiva. So when the jiva chooses not to enjoy separately, but rather to offer everything to the Supreme Lord, he makes a different choice. He's not forced one way or the other, but he makes a different choice. And when he does so, then he is free from the suffering of the material world. So there is no fault on the part of the Lord that causes the jiva suffering. Actually, he encourages the jiva to do the opposite, to surrender to him. And if a person makes a little bit of an attempt in that direction through a little bit of devotion, then the Lord encourages that and helps him increase that at all times. So that is the Lord's compassion. The suffering of the material world also, we have to look at it from another perspective. Yes, it is the responsibility of the jivas. The other point, of course, is that the purpose of that suffering is to make the jiva understand that he has to be responsible for his actions. And he has to analyze very carefully, why am I doing all of this? And if he doesn't do that, then he will continue to suffer in the material world. So in the Bhagavatam it says that the devotee, when he is afflicted by suffering, understands that it is atma-kritam. That suffering is self-produced. He understands the law of karma. I'm suffering now because I've done some activities, and now I have to get the result of that. So he doesn't blame the Supreme Lord. He doesn't blame anybody else. Usually when we suffer, we have to blame someone else. This person, that person, they're causing me to suffer. And ultimately, maybe say, the Supreme Lord did it, so I can't believe in him anymore because he's cruel. So, we can't blame anyone else. Our suffering is related to our own acts. So when we take responsibility, then we can progress. How do we progress? We change our acts. First level is, okay, let's not do the sinful acts, let's do the punya acts. We can cancel out the suffering with some nice enjoyment in the material world. So that's basically karma yoga. All varnashrams is the art of dharma, kama. Do acts of dharma, and this way we get our artha, we get enough to survive, and we also get extra enjoyment, kama. So that's the first level through suffering. You say, okay, we don't want the suffering, let us do some punyas and control our senses a little bit, and we can counteract that and get up. So if we regulate ourselves, control the mind to some degree, then we can actually start to avoid the suffering. So Krishna gives system of dharma for that. Follow the rules and regulations, understand what is sin, what is pious activity, papa and punya, etc. Become educated a little bit. So that's one way the Lord is merciful. If a person agrees that, yes, we don't want to suffer in this material world. So suffering has a purpose in that sense, to motivate us to follow dharma. But of course, we see in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna also says, well, this, the Vedas are flowery words. They keep us in the material world, actually. So whether it is the, you know, sattva, raja, or tama, it's all bondage, actually, whether you have gold chains, silver chains, or iron chains. You're still in the material world. So simply living comfortably in the material world also is not the ultimate solution to the problem. So therefore, people will try to get out of the material world, and therefore we have moksha. Get out. So in itself, yes, this is a logical progression. After the punya aspect and you enjoy the material world, then you realize that even when you're enjoying the material world peacefully, this is not perfect because you still have suffering, giving up material bodies constantly, etc. So then one in sattva gun will understand we're not the body at all, we're atma, and we go for moksha. Get out of the material world, separate the atma from the body. So we do jnana and yoga for that purpose. So that's the second step, solution to suffering. But that's not complete, because the jiva is not simply an entity who has to get rid of his suffering. As I said, he has a propensity for enjoyment, for joy, for ananda. That is not satisfied simply by getting rid of the suffering, and that's exactly what moksha is. We get rid of the material body, gross and subtle. We get rid of birth and death. We get rid of all the desires. We get rid of so, and the atma cannot be afflicted by, you know, heat, cold, getting cut or anything like that. So moksha is a freedom from all the afflictions we know of in the material world, and birth and death and hunger, etc. But that's all it is. It's peaceful existence. But the jiva deserves more than that. He has a propensity for bliss. But the only way that can manifest is when he serves the Supreme Lord. So therefore the ultimate process is bhakti. So very nicely, the process of bhakti does whatever karma, jnana, and yoga also do by itself. So you can get the material things also, since the Lord controls the law of karma anyway. And bhakti is the best punya. You can get everything in the material world, and you want Swarga, you can also go there, you go to Brahmaloka, whatever. But, and you can also get the freedom from pain, etc. You can get the moksha. You can get rid of your material body, subtle body, gross body, birth and death, etc. But, so these are secondary effects. The real effect is the jiva becomes completely satisfied and full of bliss in association with the Supreme Lord in the spiritual world. So in that position of serving the Lord in the spiritual world, automatically, whatever enjoyment you could have got from things in the material world, the enjoyment of moksha, all of that is automatically there, but it is insignificant in comparison to the bliss of a relationship with the Lord in rasa. That is the actual perfection of the jiva. So, there are various statements, various philosophers who will tell you what is the cause of suffering, etc., but because it's all speculative, and if, even if they follow Vedas, they are bound to make mistakes also unless they follow the proper parampara. We have to take the version of the Bhagavatam as the final say in the matter. And that accepts them. The law of karma is there, and above that is, of course, beyond the law of karma is our relationship with the Supreme Lord. Okay.
You mentioned in the verse that there are different opinions of theoretical philosophers. So we have the Buddhists and the Shankarites. So what are the main points on which their teachings are based, both Buddhism and Shankara, and how did Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu refute them?
Well, of course, the Buddhist philosophy is it rejects the Vedas, so it's not based on the Vedas, but we can say maybe it's influenced by it. And particularly, it's a reaction against the Karmakanda section of the Vedas, where they do sacrifices and kill animals and try to enjoy the material world. It's also a reaction against the austerity of yogis and other things who have to do such penances, etc. Buddha himself did penances for a long time, then he finally said, this is not the proper way to do things. So he chose the middle way or whatever. So his path is moderate and non-violent. Not extreme like yoga or jnana, and not the opposite, intensive karma yoga with enjoyment and killing animals, etc. As part of method is concerned. In terms of philosophy, it is, what can I say, nihilistic. Nothingness. Using a lot of logic. That actually nothing exists. And the whole process is to negate our ignorance of thinking things exist. And ultimately get a position of negation. And nothing exists. So, Shankara's philosophy is somewhat similar in the sense that it's like nothingness, the final goal, because there's no form, no qualities, no activities. But he calls it Brahman. So using a lot of logic also, similar to the Buddhists, he establishes the Brahman on the basis of Shruti, Upanishads. And rather than say, no scripture, he says, okay, we'll follow scripture, and we understand that Brahman is the absolute entity. And everything we see here is illusion. So that aspect is the same as the Buddhist, the illusion part of it. Everything here is illusory, your body, idea of Atma, mind, everything is Atma, everything is illusion. The difference is, even Supreme is illusion in Buddhism. But there is a supreme in Shankara's philosophy, that is Brahman. That is real. Everything else is unreal. In Buddhism, nothing is real. So we just get rid of the illusion and then we're left with nothing. So in Shankara, no. We get rid of the illusion, we're left with Brahman. No jiva, only Brahman. I am Brahman. The similarity is that the nothingness is very similar to the Brahman, because the Brahman has no qualities, form, or activities, or name, or anything. So it is very similar. So, many people, of course, not only we say that, but others also, scholars will say that he borrowed a lot of the concepts of Buddhism and stuck it into the Vedic, forced it into the Vedic philosophy, forced interpretations of the Vedas to bring about that philosophy. So there's some similarity to Buddhism. He was successful in that. At one time, Buddhism spread all over India. It was in South India. You see, even Lord Chaitanya's time, there were Buddhists there. It was up in North India, Ashok. And you see, go to Orissa, you'll see Buddhist stupas in there. It was in Bengal, in Bangladesh, you'll see the remnants of Buddhist temples there, etc. It was, of course, Gaya and all other places. It spread all over India, probably due to Ashok, Emperor Ashok. He became a Buddhist and he spread it everywhere in India. So people were worried. Followers of the Veda, the Karmamimamsakas were defeated and they were worried. the Vedas are going to disappear. So then Shankaracharya appeared, and he was a real. The Buddhists were not only because of the king, because they had very clever use of logic. Anyone, in other words, how do you defeat a philosophy? By logic. So they could defeat all of the other people. They could defeat the Karmamimamsakas, the followers of Jaimini. They could defeat everybody else because they're very, very skillful use of logic. the main idea is that even if the king does conquer, usually you have to have debates. And the winner of the debate, the king will accept that philosophy. So that happened. And, the Buddhists were very, very clever. a very sophisticated use of logic, so they could defeat everyone. So they spread everywhere. So, but then Shankar came along, and his philosophy, he was able to defeat the Buddhists. So that philosophy took hold again, and then his philosophy became prevalent all over India, and Buddhism began to wane also at the same time. So he is attributed to part of that, what, defeat of Buddhism, and again, establishment of the Vedas.
Buddhist philosophy, they don't believe in soul. But Vaishnava philosophy, you have to see Krishna in all, everybody. So the contradiction, how we...
What is that?
The contradiction. This, I think they say, there is no soul.
Yeah, yeah, ultimately, no, no.
And Vaishnava philosophy is saying, we have to see Krishna in everybody.
Yeah.
So how do we compromise with you?
Well, we reject that philosophy completely. In the Buddhism, you have to see nothing everywhere. Nothingness. Well, actually, you can destroy your karmas before that. Even accidentally, you can destroy all your karmas in the case of Ajamil, provided you don't have any aparad. Ajamil didn't have any aparad, so therefore, when he said, Aname Aso Narayana, all of his karmas, past, present, future, were destroyed. So, destruction of karmas is not a particularly great thing for bhakti or even just chanting the name accidentally. So it can happen long before diksha, in one sense. Now the problem is, apparent problem is that even Ajimil didn't look like he had destroyed all those karmas because he was still doing sinful activities after he chanted the name Narayana. So Vishnu Chakravarti says it is an aparad to think that his karmas were not destroyed, because then we commit the offense of, you know, thinking that the name is not all powerful, that the glories of the name are imaginary. So we cannot think that. So his karmas were destroyed. There's an appearance of karma for him. It looked like he was still under the influence of the modes and still a sinful person, actually, and still doing sinful activities. But no, all of his acts had no reaction. And this is like the snake with no teeth. It bites and nothing happens. So he's doing all these sinful activities, no effect. So, it looked like he's undergoing karmas. No, there's no karmas at that point. But there's a little pattern that looks like karma. Yeah? So, in other words, sometimes the holy name or bhakti will hide the fact that the karmas are destroyed, and the pattern of karma will remain, but technically the Lord has already destroyed it all. That's in the case of a person who's committed no aparads. If they commit aparads, then there's a slower case of destruction of karmas. So therefore we have something like anartha navritti, where gradually you're destroying things, and then you get anishtha ruchi asakti. So that anartha navritti, the anarthas including the karmas and the desires and the ahankar, are gradually getting destroyed as you go through nishtha ruchi asakti and even into bhava. So it's that in bhava the last remnants of ahankara get destroyed. Before that, in the last stage of asakti, the karmas are finally eradicated. So in sadhana itself, by the end of sadhana, asakti, then the karmas are gone. And the only thing that remains is the traces of ahankara, which are destroyed in bhava stage. Well, because you perform bhakti, but of course it's not only then, you can say also before then, you chant the holy name. Now, technically in other ages or whatever, there was no real process of, you know, doing Hare Krishna and chanting for 6 months or 8 months or 2 years or whatever, and then finally take initiation after so long. It was a much quicker process, so you meet the guru and then you take initiation and finish like that. So your bhakti and getting initiated by the guru are more or less simultaneous. You take initiation, then you perform bhakti in many cases like that. So in which case, when you take your initiation and start performing bhakti, then you destroy your karmas. So Kleshagni takes place with any bhakti, not just the holy name. So you pull the Rathyatra cart, you see the Jagannath and the Rath, you can get liberation from the material world that way, also destroy all your karmas or whatever. But destruction of karmas, as I said, is the secondary effect of bhakti. That's not the primary thing we're interested in at all. Haridas Thakur says it's like without endeavor, it happens. It's like even with namabhas, which means not pure chanting, you can get liberation without any endeavor. So that's all secondary, this the destruction of karmas and liberation, etc. The main point of bhakti is not destruction of karmas, but the cultivation of bhakti itself, to start from faith and to increase the little seed of bhakti until it grows and grows and grows and then bears fruit of prema. That's the main result of bhakti. Secondary is the karma thing and suffering and liberation, etc. That's all secondary. It's done without any effort on the part of bhakti. I think maybe the reason for that statement is the definition of bhakti, of initiation, of diksha, divyajnana into adhyayana. So, initiation means bestowal of transcendental knowledge and destruction of sin. Papasya samshayam, which is diksha, dip for divyajnana, ksha for kshaya, destruction of sin. So therefore, it's based on that. So therefore, diksha means you destroy your sins. But if we look at the definition given by Rupa Goswami, there's another verse following that. Therefore, you go to the guru, surrender everything to him, and you get the mantra from him. And then his comment is, in the mantra, there is the divyajnanam, which means your relationship with Krishna. And then through that, you destroy your sin. So that is one process, but it's not the only process of just getting divyajnanam and destroying sin, because obviously you get shiksha, and through shiksha you also get divyajnanam, and through that you can also destroy sin. Someone tells you to chant the holy name, you chant Hare Krishna, so you destroy sin that way also. So it's not limited to diksha. It's one process, and that is through mantra, the secret mantra, your deity mantras. That is what the diksha does. Huh? It would depend on the motive of those scientists and their company that's hiring them. If they're truly interested in the welfare of people, then probably they wouldn't, but usually there's a mixture there because they all want to make money, which is exploiting people again. So they're commercial firms and they're interested in profits, so we can't say it's pure motive there.
You explain the root cause of suffering, which is at the point when the jiva starts thinking individually,
yeah,
and
ignorance,
wants to enjoy for himself.
Yeah.
And maybe it's not important, but at what point does it happen? Does it happen after the Mahapralaya when the Virat Purush?
Yeah. Well, no, actually, it's a continual process, because we see that the process of pralaya and then creation goes on continually. We can't say that there was a beginning time for that creation and destruction. So the jivas are always sitting there in Mahavishnu, then they come out and they enter into the material world, and they're there for some time, lifetime of Brahma, then there's a Mahapralaya, they all go back into Mahavishnu again, and they're all under this ignorance. So it's called anadi, avidya. This keep going on and on, we cannot trace out the beginning of that, like a circle. This goes on and on and on and on and on and on.
So while the Virat Purusha Mahavishnu lies on the cosmic water during the flight time, he still has those sukshma jivas that have...
Yeah, they're all sitting inside him, okay. Resting inside him, sleeping very peacefully. When they start getting a little restless, then he pushes them all out and they go into the material world and start enjoying again, and suffering also. Well, a devotee makes the choice that I'm not the enjoyer, Krishna's the enjoyer. That's the basis of our bhakti, that we're trying to give enjoyment to Krishna, we're not trying to enjoy ourselves, we serve Krishna. So when you say Hare Krishna, how can I engage in your service, Krishna? How can I get something from you, Krishna? How can I please you, Krishna, not how I can get something for myself. So the basis of bhakti is giving to Krishna, not taking from Krishna. So that counteracts all the avidya, etc., and all the bija, the desire, and consequently the karma.
What's the effect if someone just gets tithing from Krishna but not giving? They just keep coming tithing, you know, but they're not giving.
Oh, well, Krishna also accepts that. So we see in bhakti, there's four types of people in Bhagavad Gita, the arta and the arta-arti. Those who are suffering in the material, they're praying to Krishna, please get me rid of my sufferings. So they're taking from Krishna, like Gajendra, please get me out of the crocodile's grip, like that. And then we have people that are not suffering but want a little more. Arta-arti, they want material things, so they pray, please give me, you know, some television or a house or a promotion in my job or whatever. So Krishna says that all my devotees, I accept them. So Krishna's merciful to these people because they actually worship Krishna at least. They don't go to devatas or not worship anybody. So devata worship is better than nothing, but worshiping Krishna even for material things is better. But better than that, of course, is not to go for material things and simply worship Krishna for service to him.
And what if they just come to the temple just to take them? They don't worship Krishna, they just come to take anyone. Like they're taking whatever.
Prasadam?
Well, they might take other things as well. Like stealing.
Oh, stealing. Well, if they steal from the temple, that, of course, is offense. That is aparad. That's aparad. There's no devotion there at all, in other words. Isn't it? Yeah. So I'm talking about a devotee who asks for things for Krishna, but people simply take their just aparadis, yeah, criminals. Yeah, karma, not just karma, aparad also. It's worse.
How do you fend against not taking in our own mind? Because part of our mentality of coming.
Yeah, we always want something.
We want something.
Yeah, well, we have to retrain ourselves. That's the whole process of bhakti, to retrain ourselves to don't think in terms of getting, but in
so
giving.
So the end goal is always there, though, right? You know, that we're always thinking that this will pay off eventually.
Yeah.
We're not talking about just totally giving ourselves to Krishna. How do you defend against that in
your
mind?
Well, keep practicing. Now the impetus, let's say, the stimulus for that is that by doing so, we get peace, and we get satisfaction. And of course, as we progress, then if you go up to Bhava and Prema, then you get Ananda, you get bliss. So there is a little motivation there, you get a little reward for your sacrificing everything to Krishna, you get become very peaceful. And you can tolerate things in the material world. Well, sometimes mind means everything. The whole thing, chitta, ahankara, mind and intelligence are all grouped together, so we can broadly say it's also mind. On the practical level, of course, we're not so conscious of ahankara. It's there, but it's very subtle. So therefore, the direct cause is the mind with holding all the desires. So we can say that's the direct cause. But of course, behind that, of course, if we look in the Kapila's analysis, behind them, above the mind, is ahankara. So we have to take the statements together and then see the final conclusion. Sometimes it looks like contradictions, but we have to see what is the final conclusion. They make statements in a very general way sometimes.
If we in tune our free will to Krishna, will our life be bliss?
We?
Sorry. If we have free will.
Yeah. Blissful life. The Atma becomes completely blissful, and if we can perfect that, it's eternal.
Mm-hmm. what place do other religions of the world have in terms of what we heard today, like Christianity, Judaism, Islam? They are not based on Vedas, so are they still inferior to all these?
Well, they have some similarities, and if we compare them, many, of course, Buddhism doesn't accept the supreme largest illusion of the world. We also accept the world as illusory in one sense because it is Maya, but not in the absolute sense of illusory. But if we take Christianity, Islam, Judaism, then we'll see there is similarity in the idea that there's one God, one supreme God, who is creator, who is omniscient, etc. So, and then we have the jivas. Now the concept of jiva is a little vague. What is the soul? Is the soul the body? Well, it's a little bit vague there. But they do have an idea of a difference between the jiva, the individual, and the Supreme Lord, and they don't merge them together. So that's also common. The difference, of course, or the common element, we could say in one sense, is that much of the idea of God is more like Brahman, no form, no qualities, no activities. In Judaism and in Islam, it's somewhat like that. Then in Christianity, we probably get a little more personality of God. But then there's a confusion between Christ and God also there. There's a sense of relationship also in some places in the Bible, even the Old Testament, with the Songs of Solomon, some sort of relationships are established. Even a Madhurya relationship, I think, a little bit, a shadow of it like that. So there's, but it's not very commonly recognized, let's say. If we go to Christian saints, like St. Teresa, I think it is, then we get ecstasies like, you know, Satvika Bhavas, etc. also in relation to God. So there is some similarities also in that sense. But in terms of philosophy, we can say that their concept is somewhere maybe Brahman and Paramatma, generally, somewhere in that area, and doesn't get up to Bhagavan very much at all. Maybe some factors are there, personal relation, but not very evident. So the idea of form, qualities, activities, and pastimes, particularly, pastimes are quite absent. they don't talk about the pastimes of the jiva with God in the spiritual world. So we say there's partial elements of truth there, but not a complete picture. Just as these other philosophers, even they take the Vedas as partially correct, but not completely correct.
So Maharaj, we also see that like Bhagavan realization is the ultimate, and we have these four one of our Vaishnava Sampradayas which teach us about the realization of the personality of the Lord. Where does the worship of Lord Ram fit in these four Sampradayas? Because all of them propagate Vishnu worship, but we see there are so many Ram Bhaktas and there's a planet in the spiritual world called Ayodhya where it could be a destination for Ram Bhaktas. So is there any other Sampradaya for Ram Bhaktas?
Well, they don't reject Ram. We have deities of Rama in like Sri Rangam temple. There's a Ram deity in one of the temples there. So they don't reject it. But they take the original form or the main form as to be Vishnu. But they accept these other forms like Rama, Krishna, and Hayagriva, etc. And they worship them also. There is one sect called the Ramanandi sect, which claims to be a branch of the Ramanuja Sampradaya. I don't know if the Ramanujas strictly accept them, but they claim that. And in North India, they're a little bit tantric influenced, and they have long hair and whatever like this, and they go to the Kumbh Mela, etc. So they claim to be followers of Ramanuja. So they're mainly Ram Bhaktas.
But there is no
Sampradaya which is dedicated. They call them the highest, as far as I see, no. Okay, Hare Krishna.
His Holiness Bhanu Swami Maharaj.